Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 229 of Yes But Why podcast, my talk with improviser and comedian Tom Booker. But first, let's check out our sponsors. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This episode of Yes But Why is also sponsored by my company, PodcastCadet.com. Podcast Cadet is dedicated to helping you build your podcast. We will connect you to the resources you'll need to get better and better with each and every episode. Swing on by PodcastCadet.com to get help for all your podcasting needs. Let us know you heard about us from Yes But Why, and you'll get 20% off the workshop or service you buy. This week on Yes But Why, I interview actor and comedian Tom Booker. Tom Booker is an actor, improviser, writer, voice actor, and director. Tom is the owner of the Institution Theater, an improv comedy theater located here in Austin, Texas. In our chat, Tom tells me about learning from Del Close and Mick Napier in the heyday of Chicago improv theater. Tom shares his experience of touring with the production of The Real Live Brady Bunch. I was excited to hear his stories, and I'm happy to share them with you. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 229, Ride the Wave of Comedy with Tom Booker. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
What was the first show where you knew, oh yeah, this is the thing, this is what I want to do?
I think it would be 1982 at Nathan Hale High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with there was a like a student talent show type thing called Hale Baloo.
Nice.
Yeah, it's Nathan Hale. You know, we also used to say, Hale, yes.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, like what high school did you go to?
What high school did I go to?
Yeah.
I went to Ursuline Academy.
Okay, so it would be like, Hale, yes. Ursuline, no.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Fun.
So, yeah. Oh, Tulsa. And
tell me about the talent show. Were you the host, the MC?
I was not the host, but I was in a lot of things, especially there was a band from our high school, a bunch of good guys, they formed a band called Lynx, L-Y-N-X, and they were trying to make it big. There was a breakup, and then they changed their name to Image. But a bunch of friends and I formed a band called The Missing Lynx, and we had our two songs, Centerfold by the Jay Giles Band and I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett. And I hopped around that stage and jumped around, and I'd been in plays and everything before, and I was thinking about this a few days ago, how I was the world's worst student council president, but I, you know, had funny speeches, but I think it was then that I thought that this is something that saw that I was something I was pretty good at, and then when I became the mascot for the University of Oklahoma basketball team, that's when I realized this is what I want to do. I like people looking at me.
Really?
Yes.
Did you like the fact that you had like a mask? Like, because you wore like a suit, right?
Oh, no. I told everybody that I was top dog. Yeah, I had a suit.
You still wore it at the event.
I'm such a whore. And in fact, this is how much more. When the bars would close, Norman, Oklahoma, because I used to drink a lot, and the bars would close, I would stand on a bar stool and shout, "Who wants to fuck Top Dog?" Top Dog was our basketball mascot, and
oh
I will
my
tell
God.
You, nobody. And then later, we were just talking about when we were doing the Real Life Brady Bunch in New York, and the bars would close in New York, I would stand on a bar stool and say, "Who wants to fuck Bobby Brady?" And again, nobody.
These seem like rough things to try to be sexy about, though.
Everybody wants to fuck Gray Brady.
You really, yeah. I mean, legit. Also, he's kind of an adult, so you feel less bad about it. Right? Yeah, I mean,
in hindsight, I guess I'm probably pretty lucky that no one picked up on the Bobby Brady thing.
Probably good that didn't work out. I like that you maintained a consistent effort, though. I mean, at least you were asking for permission, I suppose.
I was, it just shows you how picky I wasn't. You know, who was, all right.
I feel like a lot of my dating life was like that, too. It'd be like, what? You? Great. Sounds like a good time. Let's head out. I'd be like, who's that guy? I don't know. We'll see.
That's kind of the 80s for me.
Yeah.
There was a lot of like, oh, I guess we're dating now. So we're having a lot of sex. I guess, okay.
Oh, sure. I guess what that is.
You're here. Yeah. I'm here. We're good. Okay.
I assume the 80s was a wild time. I mean, as far as what I imagine it being like wild drug times, I imagine everyone was cocaine fueled. Was there a lot of that in your high school?
Not in the high school, but in Chicago, yes. But not some. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money. But no, my high school was pretty pretty tame. And then when I went to college and found out that everybody else's high school seemed to be like it was a new movie at the time, Porky's.
Right.
And I was like, oh wow, no, we're gonna really get open in this podcast.
You can tell me whatever you want, no problem.
I didn't have sex till my sophomore year in college, and that was a good thing for me.
Yeah,
I would not have been. I was barely emotionally prepared for it in college. So.
Yeah, I had a similar situation. I waited until my mid-20s because I was like, yeah, I don't. That's not a thing I need to do. But thanks though. You're real nice. That's great.
No, it was different for me. No one was offering.
Sure. No one was offering for me either. You know, just to be honest.
But in hindsight, I'm like, I was a little nutty. So
sure.
It wouldn't have helped. It would not have helped.
No, not at all. Plus you were getting all that attention as the mascot, right?
Yep.
You were the big crowd screaming.
Didn't come until my junior year, so it didn't come until after sex. Yeah.
Oh, you think they're correlated? You think they were like, well, we were going to hire you last year, but you weren't ready.
Now you are. Now you've got that look in your eye, Booker.
Different
look
about
of
you.
A man who just had sex.
Yeah, I feel like that's something they tell you when you're a kid, that like they can look at you and they can tell. Like, you can't tell anything.
I do remember walking in the mall with my friends the day after and like seeing myself in mirrors as I walked, thinking I should look different.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big deal. And then as time passed, you're like, oh, not really.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think as you get older, you like lack firsts. There are few things that I haven't, like I'm saving a few for when I'm old. Like I make jokes and I'm like, listen, if I hit 80, I'm doing heroin. I'm just saying, like, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do it. But if I'm 80, like I earned it, right? Like, let's do this, right?
Yeah. That's interesting. You do go from doing first to I'm sick of this shit. Like I remember shortly after I moved to Austin, you know, I was a huge star in L.A., really, but, you know, and so I was doing a French film.
Sure, that bond, you're good.
It was one of those things that like, hey, what should I bring for my costumes? I'll just bring your whole closet. We'll figure it out there. And so I was walking in the Texas heat, carrying every stitch of clothing that I own. And I just remember it was the first time I ever had this thought. It was 43, and I thought, I'm getting too old for this shit. Then I realized that from then on, my life was just going to be a continuous stream of declarations of I'm getting too old for this shit, until finally the last thing is like breathing. I'm getting too old for this shit. And then that's it. Then you just flatline.
And you're just tired of it.
Yeah.
You're like, forget it. And it's done.
Yeah.
I don't think that's how it works, but I appreciate the idea of it. I like the poetry of the scenario, for sure.
If they don't love me by now, they never will.
Oh, my God. No, you have so many chances. That's the beautiful part about it. And I like the idea that you moved around from city to city. So we started in Oklahoma. Right now, I've heard, well, okay, I haven't heard a city. I don't know where University of Oklahoma is. But so I got Oklahoma, I got Chicago, I got Los Angeles, I got Austin. There's so much adventure in here. I like how much you moved.
Yeah.
So tell me about, after you said the mascot was the thing that like got you excited about performing, you were like, you know what? I dig this attention. How did you foster it after that?
Well, I had a roommate from Chicago. I'd never been to Chicago, and he, went to high school with someone he used to identify as Joel or Bill Murray's brother. Turns out it was Joel Murray. And he told me about this place called Second City. And so the job to get with, I would have gotten a journalism telecommunications degree, and the job to get at that time from University of Oklahoma with my degree was to run the camera at a network affiliate station in Oklahoma City, and that paid $3.10 an hour, which was minimum wage. And I thought, I can make minimum wage anywhere. I'm going to move to Chicago. And so I called up Second City. And I said, hi, I'd like to take classes at Second City. And they're like, do you have any improv experience? Nope, but I was a mascot for University of Oklahoma. And they told me about this place called Players Workshop of Second City. And so I thought I graduated. Turns out I was 3 hours short. I used to drink and do a lot of drugs. So I didn't really get my college degree until 1994. So I went in 82 and graduated in 94. So I like to say I went to college for 12 years because I would take these correspondence courses, but when you're drinking and doing drugs, it's really hard to keep up with that sort of thing. And I didn't make that joke around my dad because my parents paid for my college and he didn't think it was funny.
Sure, they hate that. They really don't like it. Yeah.
Yep. And so I moved up to Chicago and I flew in on a Tuesday and started my first improv class on a Wednesday. And I remember going to class and I instantly had 12 new best friends. And I remember thinking, these are my people. And it was weird because I was in a room filled with 12 other class clowns. The last time I felt like that was when I was at mascot camp in 1986.
Ooh, mascot camp.
Went to mascot.
Sure, that makes sense that they would, have a this is how you do it scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. So that's fun. You got in there. You got into Players Workshop, I'm assuming, is like, what is the conservatory end of Second City? Like,
it was like Second City Prep. It was started by Josephine Forsberg. And it was in a way connected to Second City, but you would go through their program. And the teachers were, Martin DeMott was one of the teachers. And who started the conservatory.
Yeah.
And so you would go through that. I think it was like a 9-month program. And then you would audition to get into the conservatory at Second City.
Did he run Second City New York for a while?
I don't know. He lived in New York. He was from New York.
From another story, name sounded familiar. And I was like, ooh, am I connecting Second City things? Cool. I like it.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how was the vibe there? You said you met 12 of your best friends. Did it really work out that way? Was it like you, as soon as you got there, you just like felt at home and like Chicago was awesome, like an awesome place to spend your 20s?
Oh yeah. And I went there I was there at a great time. It was great. And, there were just all these people moving to Chicago, graduating from college, moving to Chicago and to study at Second City to try and get on Saturday Night Live. And Chicago was an old city, is an old city, and rent was still pretty, very cheap. Since it's an old city, the buildings are old. Since the buildings are old, the ceilings are high. Since the ceilings are high, any building can pretty much be a theater. And so there were a lot of us there, and everybody, we just started theaters, you know, groups just started performing everywhere. And there was an audience there that would support new stuff, and no one was watching. It gave us time to fail, you know, and Sharna was there with Improv Olympic at the time. I was at Improv Olympic back when she was getting sued by the International Olympic Committee.
Sure.
And they really didn't, they weren't too concerned with Sharna, but at that time there was something called the Gay Olympics. And so the International Olympic Committee did not like that, but they couldn't just go after the Gay Olympics. Gay Olympics is now, or I don't know if it's still around, called the Gay Games. Del was there. Del was, I think that a lot of times there are improv teachers that are, this is the way you do it. And Del wasn't one of those people. You know, he would guide you, but he was open to new things. And so there was also just a group of young people who would try new things for part of the reason was to try and impress Del, you know, because he was such a, I don't know if mentor is too strong a word, just someone that had been there before, you know, and had been at Second City. And like, I love that he palled around with Lenny Bruce. That's pretty cool. And since no one was watching, we had room to fail.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a really, really good time to be there.
Now, I wonder if you mentioned that Del wasn't exactly a mentor. Was he not exactly a mentor to you, but he was to other people? Because, like, you know, some people, and what I would consider you, are sort of leaders in their own right. Like, they have, and I know that I've met you in adulthood, so I don't know what you at 20 was like, you know, and I you don't know what I was like when I was 20, but like, you know, there's sort of like a self-assuredness, I'm going to take care of myself. Like, I've had some mentors, but not that many, because I've always been like, yeah, I can learn it. Sure. Like, I've listened to people and like take in their lessons for sure. But it's like some people really, I don't know, some people really like hang on every word of certain people. And that's what I always imagined happened with Del. People like
were
overblowing how much of a genius he was. I was like, yeah, he seems like your average schmo, but he just seemed to get a lot of people excited. So right. Great.
Yeah, we would hang on his every word. And there were people that were like, there was Chris Barnes, and I think of Adam McKay, Matt Besser, you know, there were a number of Mick Napier. I was just always scared of everything at that time, including Del. And Del did nothing. That's just where I came from. And the very first show that I ever put together, I remember Del came to opening night and he stood up and he said, "Bravo!" and then walked out. And I was just like, Del just said "Bravo." But it was just his willingness to break the rules and see what happens, you know, and to see that that's okay. And there's a woman named Frances Callier who used to run the Second City Training Center in Los Angeles, and she used to describe it as Second City was the source, Improv Olympic freed the form, the Annoyance Theater freed the actor. And that was, you know, Del created this form, the Herald, and he would teach that. But then, you know, we would learn the Herald, the structure of the Herald, so we could break the rules and see what would happen. But we always knew we could come back to the structure.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I always think about that when I think about rules and whatnot, because when I'm personally teaching, I'm usually teaching, you know, level one. And I'm like, I'm going to give you a bunch of rules and tell you you have to do it a certain way. And then when they get to their recital day, I'm like, anything that happens is fine. These were just guidelines to help shape your brain to think of things in a certain way. You don't have to do anything that we talked about. You don't have to try anything. Just talk. And you're good. Like, especially at level one recital, I'm like, hey, man, you're here. Yes.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
But
yeah,
rules are meant to be broken.
Yes, exactly. I think especially in creativity.
Yeah.
And because you don't know what's coming next, and you want to see what's next. That's what's exciting about it.
So did you feel at the time that you were in on something special, like creating a form, creating a wave of creativity that, you know, because you were part of that scene, and that scene is kind of like the, like we were even talking about Andy Warhol earlier, like that's if for improv, that's exactly what that was, like the pinnacle of people figuring out how to put it together. And the lessons learned during that time literally are the blueprint for every improv school across America.
I don't know if we realized that we were part of a scene, because that would I think require expectation, and we really didn't know what was going to happen. We were just kind of following our hearts. I did know that, and I did know that I felt great, and that I was with some very, very smart, and creative and kind people. You know, we're all mostly in our 20s, there were overreactions to stuff, but it was nice to, you know, just that we were just creating stuff that had never been seen before.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from your point of view, I like the idea that a lot of people, you know, went to Second City knowing that they had a plan. They're like, oh, I want to do this. But you were like, what's that? It's a cool place to hang out. Cool. I'll call them and head there immediately. Like, you know what I mean? Like you didn't have to do that. You also didn't know ahead of time, like what you were planning on creating. So, you know, you got there and had a great sort of organic experience, both of like friendship and like, oh, cool, I get to create all this stuff. Tell me about the projects that you worked on. You mentioned the Brady Bunch show. Was that the pinnacle of your like creativity when you were there? Or were there other shows that you remember as being the ones that were your like, oh man, I learned the most. This was the best.
Probably the place that I first started performing regularly was at Improv Olympic. We're at a place called Cross Currents. And I was with a group called Blue Velveeta. And that was a lot of fun. We were just a bunch of close friends. Sharna put us together. And we eventually became a house team for Improv Olympic. And it was great. And I years later, I didn't know this at the time, but years later, Sharna said that she considered us the best group ever at the Structured Herald. I didn't know. And then through that, I also studied at Second City, the Second City Training Center, and worked with a number of people. But my first teacher at Second City was Mick Napier. I was in Mick Napier's very first improv class at Second City, and I knew Mick from Improv Olympic. And Mick had done a show with a bunch of friends of his from college called Splatter Theater. It was a show that they developed through improvisation, and it was a spoof of slasher films from the 80s. And there was a little room above the Cross Currents where Improv Olympic was performing, and Mick had created this little space. He set it up to look like a living room. And so there were couches and chairs and tables, and there was carpet right in front of the stage, and people would sit on the floor. And then the table on the tables were candy dishes filled with cigarettes. A different time. And not only smoking and drinking allowed, it was encouraged. My favorite part was there was a no smoking section, and there were two chairs that Mick could put on top of a radiator. Anyway, they decided to remount a show called, they were going to do Splatter Theater too, and they're going to try and do it on a larger scale. And I auditioned for Splatter Theater too, and I got in. I was the role of Class Dick. But at that time, Tim Meadows and Dave Rozowski, who were both cast, there was a double cast as the lead, Carl, got hired by Second City to be in a touring company. And so I got the role of Carl. So I played Carl in Splatter Theater, and it was when Cross Currents was closing down. And there were, I think, 13 deaths in Splatter Theater, and it was just chocolate syrup with red food coloring everywhere. And at the end, when Cross Currents was closing down, there was little or no running water, and there was no hot water. And so we would all have to wash this chocolate syrup off our bodies with cold water. We just were around one basin. But anyway, after Splatter Theater did not go well. And, I mean, the show went well, but the production lost money. And Mick decided that he wanted to improvise a show. He wanted to call it Co-Ed Prison Sluts the Musical. It was going to be a musical about women in prison. And he wanted to have a drag queen fight a fully dressed circus clown. And so he asked me to be a part of the cast of Co-Ed Prison Sluts the Musical. And we developed that through improvisation, and the show, it ran for 11 years. I wasn't in all 11 years, but it was kind of a hit. And it was, since our rent was so low, it was, Mick had made it, it was free to get in, you paid to get out. we would just pass the hat at the end of the night. And it was a lot of fun. We did a preview for the members of Improv Olympic on Thursday night. After they did their Thursday performance downstairs, they came upstairs to watch our show, and they just looked very confused. And we realized something was wrong. Our opening night was the next night, and we stayed up all night and reworked the show. During that time, Susan Messing went to the hospital, passed a kidney stone, and came back, and we finished our rehearsal about dawn, and then we opened to a standing ovation that night.
Why did she come back? Why didn't she just rest?
It's Susan Messing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No, since it's Susan Messing, she brought the kidney stone with her to show it to us. And so then through the, we eventually got it became the Cross Currents became another place called Cotton Chicago, and they eventually got evicted from there, and the owner did not know that we were upstairs. And so all our stuff got put out on the street, but there were a bunch of homeless teens, since our show was free to get in, that would come and see the show every Friday and Saturday night, and they stood and watched our stuff to make sure no one took.
Aww.
Yeah. And
that's
then,
so nice.
Yeah. I know. Isn't that touching? And so that's
it's like
Mick
the
found.
Actual real characters of the musical Rent were helping you.
Exactly.
Because they were on the streets. They were like, let's help the arts, right?
They were, we were at Cross Currents. We were at, I think, Wilton and Belmont. And around the corner at the time was a punk rock juice bar. So teens could go there, called Medusa's. And so these kids would come and they'd watch Co-Ed Prison Sluts. We did it at 10:31 on Fridays and Saturday nights. And then they'd go around the corner to Medusa's. And they had those very long mohawks, and they would sit right in front. And Mark Sutton dubbed it the chicken coop section, because when the kids were watching the show, when they moved their heads back and forth, they looked like a bunch of chickens. And so the chicken coop gang watched our stuff for us. And then Mick found a building, and that's when the Annoyance Theater started. And I think that, and we continued to develop shows through improvisation. We did, after Co-Ed Prison Sluts, we did That Darned Antichrist. And then we did a show called Your Butt. And I was Laura Hall, who's the musical director for Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Right.
Used to be Laura Wasserman, and she used to be my piano teacher. But when you drink and do a lot of drugs, you really don't practice piano or have it together enough to tell your piano teacher, I shouldn't come today because I didn't practice. But I would show up, and we would just talk for half an hour, and we became friends. She still charged me, I think it was $12 for half an hour at the time. She Amen. Still charged me $12, and we became friends, and she was playing the piano for Co-Ed Prison Sluts at the time, and Your Butt, and That Darned Antichrist, because we did That Darned Antichrist at 8, Co-Ed Prison Sluts at 10:31, and in between shows, Laura and I would walk down to Baskin-Robbins on Broadway and get ice cream. And but anyway, we decided that we were going to write a musical together, and we wrote Manson the Musical. which we did at midnight. So I'd have a show at 8 o'clock, 10:31, and then midnight. And Manson, I love a guy named William Castle, who is the king of the gimmick. Like, he would have movies come out, and he would, this would 50s and 60s, and he'd have buzzers underneath the theater seats. So at a certain point, the projectionist would push a button and the seats would shake. And so with Manson the Musical, first it was $6 to get in, $5 if you had an X on your forehead. And we gave out little hits of acid, which were those small chiclets. And Laura had written an acid trip song, and so we'd have, at a certain point, we'd have the audience take their acid. And we announced that they were all placebos except for one, and that person's really going to enjoy the show. And then we'd have them take their acid, and then we'd present an acid trip on stage.
Wait, was that true?
Well, no, there was no acid.
It'd be very affordable if you just had one. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be like, this is feasible, guys. We could do this. I mean, probably not legally in any real way, but I love the idea of this and the idea that one of them is actually get drugs in it and the rest of it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's
John Favreau, he played Wojtek Frykowski.
In Manson the Musical?
In Manson the Musical.
Oh my God.
And who else was it? Kate Flannery from The Office was in it. Melanie Hutsell, who went on to do Saturday Night Live.
Wait, Melanie Hutsell?
Yeah. Do you know Melanie?
Well, no, not personally, but she was my like SNL person. Like, she was the person when I was in high school that I identified with the most. Like, when I watched SNL, she was my gal. And recently I've been looking her. I looked her up because I was telling somebody this. Like, I was like, Tori Spelling, the character of Tori Spelling was like my thing in high school. Like, I did that constantly. And I used all of her jokes and all of the, every time she was in something, Amy Buttafuoco, all the things, I would turn them into school projects because they like got that I was weird and theatrical, so they let me do stuff. So like my religion project was like an SNL based on the Ten Commandments. Like, it was like whole stuff, but she was who I was like, this is who I want to be. So the fact that like you know her is kind of amazing.
A year ago for South by, she was in a movie, and Janet and I piled around with she and Fred. Yeah,
it's just so crazy. Like, I mean, it's not the smallness of the world as I get older. Not crazy, but like, I love that you were in. I love that like John Favreau in the world of people listening to this, they're like, why is she excited about that name and not the first one? I love John Favreau. That's great. But Melanie Hutsell was like my thing. You know what I mean? Like, to the point where like I think about characters I develop now and I'm like, how would she do it? Like, or how would 90s her do it? I don't know how she'd do it now, but you know what I mean? Man, that's so fun.
I'll put you in touch with her. She's wonderful.
Yeah. So, yeah. Plus you're so at this point you're in like a sort of a heightened moment of like total creativity. I love the fact that you've got like three shows a night, 8, 10:30, midnight. You're really rocking and rolling. Did you feel like when the annoyance started that you were like in at the ground level? Was it like your theater? You know what I mean?
It originally started, it grew out of something called Metroform, which were a bunch of people from Indiana, a lot of people from Indiana University and some other people. And then, but I was part of Co-Ed Prison Sluts, which was the flagship show when the space started. So I was right there. And then there were also a number of other groups happening around Chicago. There was Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, started about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group called Torso Theater, and Cardiff Giant was another. They used to do shows. One of their best shows was called LBJFKKK. and it wasn't easy in the beginning because now I think they get better houses. At the beginning, we didn't get great houses. It wasn't until the Real Life Brady Bunch started that things really took off.
Now, is that an annoyance show built the way you guys build these ones out of improv?
No, what it was Jill Soloway, now Joey Soloway, and her sister Faith. Faith was a musical director for a touring company at Second City and maybe even Second City Northwest, which was out in Schaumburg at the time. She also went to college with Mick. She was one of the Indiana University people. They had an idea to put the Brady Bunch episodes on stage. And so, you know, we were like, sure, why not? And so it started on a Tuesday night. And let's see, Mick was originally Bobby. I can't remember who Peter might have. I'm not sure if it was Ben Zook, but Steve Carell was originally Greg. Jane Lynch was Mrs. Brady. I can't remember, but it was a lot of people that when we went to New York, they were hired by Second City at the time, so they wanted to stay back with Second City. It's weird because it just people started standing in the line around the block, and we only charged like $5 and did not expect it to do what it did. And there was a guy named Eric Waddell who always wanted to be a game show host, so he developed a game show that went in front of the Real Live Brady Bunch called the Real Live Game Show, and to make it a whole evening of theater, and that was a lot of fun. And
was it all improvised, or did you do like the scripts from the show?
We did scripts. Did the scripts? It was more caricatures.
Oh.
Yeah, it was more. It was scripted, and then we would also do commercials for Annoyance Theater shows during commercial breaks.
Nice, smart.
So there would be commercial breaks, and it was just us doing caricatures of the Bradys. And then what happened was Universal, it got written up in the Chicago Tribune.
Oh.
Universal Studios found out about it because it was before the internet. And they were going to serve the Annoyance with a cease and desist order. But Sherwood Schwartz, the creator of the Brady Bunch, was going to be in town speaking at Northwestern. So he said, let me go check it out. And he came to our show on a Tuesday night, and he couldn't believe that people knew the lines because people would quote the episodes. People in the audience would quote the episodes along with the actors. And then he got up on stage for a Q&A, and everybody kept shouting his name. He said he felt like a rock star. And he could see that, you know, it was an old drag queen club that we turned into a theater. It wasn't very polished. It was perfect for us at the time. And then we were just doing it on a Tuesday night we're charging $5. And so they worked out a deal with Universal. I think the Annoyance paid them $50, you know.
Total or per show?
Per show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Either way, a bit of a ripoff, but I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So we were able to do it. And then Ron Delsener, who is I think he's retired from rock promoting, but still around. He is the rock promoter in New York for the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s. He claims he's responsible for getting Kiss back together. He found out about the show and wanted to produce it in New York. And so we ended up going to New York. And that's when I started playing Bobby Brady, because Mick was going to stay behind Chicago and continue to grow the Annoyance Theater.
Sure.
And we didn't think, you know, we thought it would be an 8-week run.
Yeah. Is that all you signed on for? And then it ended up being longer. How long was it?
It was a year in New York and then a year in LA, and then it went on tour, but I stayed in LA once it went on tour.
Oh, so like this promoter guy really got it going.
Oh yeah. And we were downstairs at Circle in the Square. We were downstairs at the Village Gate.
Right.
Madonna came and saw us. 1990 Madonna.
Oh.
And let's see, Robert Reed came. It was a lot of fun, and Limelight had parties for us. It was a neat time.
Man, it is so helpful that creator of Brady Bunch was into the show.
Yes.
I mean, really helped it continue to go, for sure.
Yeah, Sherwood was a very, very nice man.
Oh, man. I also, like, just the idea of having this, like, marketing person helping you is really amazing. It's sort of an amazing lesson when it comes to, you know, people who are trying to put on their own shows, and they're like, well, I don't understand why. It's like, if you hire a person whose job it is to make sure butts are in seats, it'll happen. But if you just hope, it's not going to happen all the time.
Well, I think the show has to be able to connect to an audience.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just like, I'm going to read the phone book and I want people to come, like, I don't, what's in it for them? You know, it's all about connection. And we just happen to be there at a time where the 70s was doing a resurgence. There, people were coming of age who had seen Brady Bunch reruns every day. And
what was this, 1990?
Yeah, it was 1990. A lot of stuff didn't make sense, you know, and it was weird because the Vietnam War was going on, and yet still there was this wholesome TV show.
Oh, no, that makes total sense, especially right now. Yeah. Like, I understand stuff like that better now. You know what? When you think about that, you're right. I can't believe they pitched and put on this show. But now that I'm sort of in a tumultuous time in the world, I'd love a Brady Bunch. Give me a happy family, for the love of God. Like, I would love that show right now. Please, someone write it. Put it on television. Pleasant people who have wacky problems and are fine. That's what we're looking for. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I remember when I was a kid and I watched sitcoms, the one thing that I appreciated was the assurance that at the end it was going to be all right.
Oh, yeah. Like, I like structure and I like repetitive things. Yeah. I think that might be why I'm a Warhol fan. And templates. I like templates a lot. And there is, I do like a good bookend, you know?
But that's why I like it, is because of the structure, because it illuminated the flow of storytelling. When I was a kid, that's how I knew. Like, I would watch movies and feel the rhythm of, like, you know, they'd be like, they're about to solve it. And I'm like, there's 45 minutes left. They haven't solved anything. Like, yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like... You know, you're watching these things. I'm the person who's got my eye on the clock going like, that's not the murderer. It is 5 minutes in and they just arrested him. He is the red herring. Come on. You know,
yeah,
like,
I
love that kind of stuff. I love the idea of a pleasant ending, a thing where, especially in a show where it's like these days, they'll kill off the lead character in 2 seconds. They're like, what's the show called? Ronnie? Ronnie's dead. You're like, what? How is Ronnie dead? It's about him. Nope, turns out it's just about Ronnie's family. Ronnie's out. You're like, oh, man. Like, but back in the day, the show was called Ronnie. Ronnie's not going anywhere.
Yeah, Ronnie was in every scene.
He's fine. If he is hanging off a building, don't worry about it.
Ronnie's going to save the day.
Yeah, it's going to be all right. You know, something comforting about that. Something like, I'm going to continue to see this person over and over. Man, the ebb and flow of art. Am I right?
I think soap operas, in a way, were kind of like that. I mean, you know, you would just see these evil people that you would fall in love with. And you knew, you know, the nice, it was going to work out eventually.
You know what, though? Based on what you were saying just now about the Brady Bunch, like doing caricatures, I kind of feel like that's what soap operas are sometimes. Like, they're doing every time, they're like, what's the craziest thing that could happen right now? Like, it's an absurd world where these big characters live. And, you know, you and I know in comedy, like, an absurd world, maybe throw a straight character in there and you're going to make it funny. But absurd characters in an absurd world, yeah, we could do this for 30 years. Like, no problem. If this guy's going to be, like, somehow shocked every time he gets betrayed, yeah, let's do it, right? Everybody in the town wants to steal money from this guy, and they will eventually, and he's going to be surprised about it. What? You know what I mean? Like, his new wife is going to, she's stealing his money. No one loves him. Guys, that's the show, you know? But there's something fun about those sort of, like, wild characters and building that. I mean, clearly, you did the Brady Bunch show for, what was it, 3 years?
I guess I was in it for 2 years, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, but you did it before. You did a year in New York and a year in L.A. How long had you been doing it in Chicago before you went on tour?
I think we did it in Chicago for about a year, I think. And I wasn't one of the main cast, but I would be things like, I'd be a student, or I was Dick Stern when they went and sang on the Dick Stern show when they were trying to, you know, get enough money for the silver platter.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Meet Davy Jones.
We did work with Davy Jones in L.A. He did a week. And then when they went on tour, they did the Davy Jones show with Davy Jones.
Oh, actual Davy Jones?
Yeah, they would do the Davy Jones. When we were in Chicago, Tom Hanks was shooting League of Their Own. And he and Rita Wilson, his wife, came to see the show because Rita Wilson was in the Brady Bunch. She played the part of the cheerleader who was like Marcia's nemesis, and then Greg kind of dates her. And she, there's a weird scene where he gets her to do a cheer in the living room, and keeps more and more, and just keeps having her saying F-F-F-I-L-L-L-L-M-O-O-O-R-E, Fillmore Junior High or Senior High, and that's Rita Wilson.
Oh my God, that's so wild. It's wild that it like touched so many people and like connected them, because I've literally heard stories on other podcasts from other comedians talking about doing this show. You know what I mean? Like like Andy Richter talks about it all the time on his podcast.
Yeah,
so it's like, this is a big deal show. This is like a, you know, a show that a lot of people got to do. And just hearing the story that like the creator was like, yep, I put my stamp of approval on it. It's cool. And then it went across the country, had all these people in it that are like now living such creative lives. Like, this was a good gig. Like, this was solid.
And then the Brady Bunch movies came out of it.
Oh, like, really?
Who knows if Universal would have thought of that if Jill and Faith hadn't thought of it.
Totally. I was going to ask if they were related, but, you know, wow, interesting.
Yeah,
of course.
Christine Taylor was our understudy, Marcia, who went on to play Marcia.
Oh, my God.
I think she was the only one of the cast that made it into the movie.
Dude, good for her, though. I mean, like, rock on. Like, as far as, like, taking an improv show or, like, taking a show that was, like, silly and camp and really, like, riding it all the way up to the top, like, heck yeah. Absolutely. I loved that movie. I was like, I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theaters. Yeah, the 90s were such a like 70s excitement time. It was like, look back, all the Dazed and Confused stuff. I mean, why do you think I moved to Austin, Texas? I mean, I don't know about you. Maybe that's why you also moved. But like that vibe, I was like, yeah, that's a thing I need to be near. That's right. So tell me about L.A. You finished doing the Brady Bunch show in the run in Los Angeles, and then you said you stayed, though the rest of the people, you know, went to Chicago or wherever in their lives. What about Los Angeles caught you? What did you want to do there?
I stayed because I thought I would be getting my TV pilot, and that never happened.
Oh, sure.
And so
you're auditioning
I didn't get a pilot, but I got sober, and my first sponsor told me that if I was in a play, I wouldn't have to go to meetings on Fridays and Saturday nights. And by that time, Laura Hall had moved out to L.A. to be with her new husband, Rick Hall. And I had a bunch of friends from Chicago that were now living in L.A. And so I formed a theater company called Theater Agogo with John Keane, who had played. I met when we took the show to L.A., he became the new Greg Brady, and a woman named Jessica Hughes. And we started doing Like the Annoyance Late Night Bad Taste Theater, developed through improvisation. Our first show was called Patty Patty Bang Bang, the Patty Hearst musical. And we got best musical of 1993 on the LA Weekly Theater Awards, and we beat out Sondheim, which we were surprised because we weren't good singers. But and then after that we did Up with Puberty, beautiful musical about the ugliest time of your life, You, Me, and LSD. And I also was in Poseidon Adventure, the musical. And we did a stage version of Valley of the Dolls. And we were in West Hollywood. And if you're a gay man of a certain age, you know the film Valley of the Dolls. And our theater sat 40, and we would cram 75 people in there. We had them sitting on ladders, and it was wonderful. And but then word got out about our show, and Lisa Bishop, who owns the rights to Jacqueline Suzanne's work, gave us a call. Apparently she didn't like us doing it without permission.
Yeah.
And I called her back, and she said, "What made you think that you could do this?" And I was honest. I said, "I didn't think anybody would come, so I didn't think you'd ever find out about it." And she came and saw the show, and she really liked it. And she wanted to get the movie remade, and she encouraged us. We bought the rights from her for $1, and she encouraged us to continue to do the show. And we called Ron Delsner, and we ended up doing the show in New York. And occasionally get calls from Lisa Bishop every once in a while, especially if there will be a charity that will call and ask if they can do a reading or a production. And she forwards them the script that we created. And she'll always call me and ask if it's okay and it's fine.
So, she's and, being Lisa, so professional.
My favorite thing about Lisa Bishop, and she's wonderful, wonderful, and was very good to us. But did you ever see the movie The Warriors?
I don't know.
All right. But there's a movie came out, I think it's 79, called The Warriors. Lisa used to be an actress. And Warriors is about a bunch of kooky gangs in New York. And there's a guy murdered when all the gangs get together at Central Park for a meeting. Cyrus, the leader of the Riffs, gets murdered. And they say that the Warriors did it. The Warriors are trying to get back to Coney so they can be safe because that's where they're from. And they run across an all-female gang called the Lizzies, and they run into them in a subway, and there's one of the Lizzie goes says, "Hiya," and that's Lisa Bishop. You'll see it.
Yeah, the Warriors.
Yeah, Warriors.
Yeah.
And so we did that, and Kate Plannery played Neely O'Hara. Kate Plannery did the... what's her name? She was in, she was married to John Astin. Sean Astin's Patty Duke, played the Patty Duke role.
I was like, and, I know this. What is it?
And Liza Coyle, who played the other lead, a woman named Melissa Christopher. Liza was in a lot, all of people were in all her shows.
Man, I feel like one of the major lessons of your story is like get the rights to the show before you do it, or make sure that the show that you do is so awesome that the creator is going to be like, you know what, you can do it. Seems fun.
Yeah, it's I mean, what's the thing is though, and even at the Institution Theater, we got cease and desist letters, but we were pretty lawsuit proof because we didn't have any money. You know, and the worst thing that happened, they would say stop, and we're okay. You know, it's not. We didn't invest a lot of money in the production.
Sure.
So, there wasn't much to lose, and it was kind of neat being an outlaw and having a sense of danger. No one's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Certainly not anything too crazy. It's going to go on for sure.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Mm-hmm.
So you're running a theater. You're running Theater Agogo in Los Angeles. I mean, everybody knows running theaters is, you know, foolproof and very lucrative. So, like, what happened? Why did you end up leaving Los Angeles? And was Austin up next, or did you go somewhere else?
What happened? Well, this was in 93, 94, and we rented St. Genesis. We just rented it for like $1,000. And there was a guy who had acting classes going on except for weekends. And that's when we used it. And it allowed us, we could go in there for rehearsals when they weren't having acting classes for free. They just kind of tossed us the keys. It was very laid back. And then when we came back from New York, the guy I'd been working with, John Keane, said, okay, we've proven we can break even at theater. Let's do a movie. And so we started getting together to write a script that we were going to do clerk style. John had already started raising some money. We were going to do it for $200,000. And we wrote this little script called Kill the Man, which was about this copy shop called Long Shot Copies. And a King Co's Copies opens up across the street. And they realize they're going to go down, but they decided to go down fighting. That was it. And John sent the script to some friends of his. One of them was a guy from his a cappella troupe in high school and who worked in a place called Summit Entertainment that was looking into getting, they've been doing distribution. They wanted to start producing films and they liked their script. And so they produced it. So we produced Kill the Man. It had Luke Wilson and Josh Molina as the stars. Terry Garr was in it. Michael McKean was in it. And it was the first film by Summit, who later went on to produce Twilight. So you're welcome. And and it went to Sundance Film Festival in 1999, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, and man. How was that?
That was great. It was great because I'd also been doing a lot of commercials. I've done about 80 commercials. And so I had some money in the bank. I was doing a...
you did commercials at good commercial time, too.
Yes, I did.
Like,
I
now
did.
They're like, here's $100. Good luck to you. And back then it was like a contract of for real.
It was, yes. It was very nice.
Great.
And, that was great. It was a lot of fun. I stayed up there for almost the whole time. I stayed up there a while. And,
man, that's so fun.
And then I started teaching at the Second City Training Center in 2001, because they, the level 5 at Second City, you put on a sketch show, and they didn't have a lot of teachers that had stage directing experience. And Dave Rosowski was the artistic director in charge, or the dean of the school at the time, and he's an old friend. And so he asked me to help out with, I was lucky enough that he, I don't want to say, he asked me, he invited me to help out and start doing level 5 shows. And I found that I really loved teaching, and I went through a very difficult divorce and needed to make a change. And someone suggested Austin. And that's when I moved out here in 2007. And I always wanted to open my own theater and improv school. Something I always wanted to do.
Man, that's crazy that you're in 2007. The weird breakup I was telling you about that got me to Austin was like 2009. So like, so close together, weird breakups send you to Austin. It's a good
thing. Oh, yeah, that's true. Or if you ever, this probably happens to you when, you know, your first day of class, when you ask someone, everybody's meeting everybody, like, what brought you to Austin? Well, there was this guy, or well, there was this girl, and then it never works out.
Yeah, man. I appreciate moving somewhere to be with somebody else. That's great. If you need a reason for an adventure, hop on it, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly in your story and in mine, you know, when I traveled, it was because there was a new show or a new thing, or like, oh, there's this theater that I want to go be part of, so let me go there. Mm-hmm. Only once did I move for a guy. And even then, when I think of it, I'm like, I shouldn't have done that. That's okay, because it led me here, and that was the right move.
I had a post-divorce girlfriend who said, you are in such a deep rut, you need to go somewhere where you can be a big fish in a small pond.
Sure.
That's what got me to Austin. Sounds pretty arrogant, but yeah.
Well, no, I mean,
and I will tell you,
you need to go to a place where you know that the people there are going to appreciate you. And if you have a skill and you know that the town seems to be into that skill, why not? Right?
Well, it's the best move I ever made. And the thing is, I was not that nice of a person before I moved to Austin. And like, you can ask people, when I first moved here, I was so scared and so nervous that all I did was drop names. All I did was drop names. And people just kind of stared at me, and it was kind of like being Tom Cruise in Rain Man, you know, like the stuff that I thought made me a hot shot, no one here cared about.
Yeah.
You know, they just like, we like you already. Shut up.
Yeah.
You know, teach us how to have fun. I needed a place to hit the reset button. And I spent the first 6 months just kind of laying on the floor crying because I didn't know what was going on. And
it's a good place for that, too.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It certainly is. And also, it's, you know, and like I said before, it's a place where you can, no one's watching. So let's try new stuff.
I mean, I would say yes and no. Like, sometimes the shows where I try the weirdest things are the ones that become most hotly attended. Like, I'm like, why did all of a sudden this many people show up? Like, we needed extra space for Patrick to flip over in the front row. Like, you know, I expected 7 people. Now there's 40. What the heck? Like, you start creating shows for expect.
That's when you're doing stuff for you.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to see this. Well, there are a whole lot of other people that would like to see this because you want to see it because you're going to be surprised. That's what they want. No one wants to see another improv show. They don't. They want to see a special improv show. Does that make sense? They want to be there at an event. They want to be surprised. I'm not saying they don't want to see improv shows. Just another improv show. We've seen that. We laugh when we're surprised. What's next? Yeah. That's what we want to see. And we want to be there for it. We want to support that person.
Yeah. Plus, I feel like what you came from, the creation of shows through improv and then sort of like letting them exist on stage and ebb and flow with the production and whatnot, you know, there is something to learning in that manner and there's something to creating in that manner that feels less scary than some of the other improv things. And when improv is scary for the performers, it is no fun for the audience.
We would we did shows for years before they were written down. Like Co-Ed Prison's Lesson, Mask and the Musical weren't written down for a long time. We knew the beats, you know, we knew there was going to be a song. Do you ever, you know, Mark Sutton and Joe Bill with Bass Prof?
Mm-hmm.
Bass Prof came about because there was a part in That Darned Antichrist where Mark Sutton and I were on stage and Joe Bill was upstage right dressed as a pig smoking cigarettes. And and so Mark played a character that he would be giving me advice. I was a character that I can't even, I did a lot of shows in the 80s that you can't do right now. And I can't even tell you about this character. It wasn't Blacklist.
Oh my God.
But there was a song, I'm Special. Anyway.
Oh boy.
Yeah. But we would have this scene together. And it would go on and on and on. So at the Annoyance Theater, a scene that went too long was called a fishing scene because we were both fishing. And then once in another show, Joe Bill and Mark Sutton were mad at jokingly so, wanted to mess with the other members of the cast. And so they decided to do a fishing scene. And I think they took up the whole hour. And that was the beginning of Bass Prof. But it was, you know, it was fun. And if it got out of hand, Mick would say something. But it was a lot of, and that's what the audience liked. And it was an environment that fit. We weren't doing it at the Long Center, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's like when I had the Institution Theater. Looking back, I really loved our first space. And I think, are you still working with the Fallout?
Occasionally. I really like
what they've done with that space, too.
Yeah,
I love all of Austin's spaces. So if anybody's up, I love your space.
I mean, spaces are lovely. They're nice to have.
But to me, the performance would begin the moment you set foot in the theater, even when you drive up. And what I loved about the Institution Theater spaces, you had no idea what to expect. In fact, you thought, I don't think that I'm overstating it when I bet there were some people who thought they might get killed. And it wasn't in a bad neighborhood, but it's just like, this looks like a place where people go in and get murdered. Am I wrong? But then you walk in and all of a sudden you just get hit by this big red paint, you know, this big bright red. We've got popcorn, we've got music playing. There's a weird bald guy walking around and, you know, and we're here for a party. That's what I used to say about theater go-go shows, that we have a party and there just happens to be a show going on.
Yeah.
When we were doing the Real Life Brady Bunch, when we were doing off-Broadway and in L.A., we would do seven shows a week. And I used to say that we do seven shows a week so we can try and get one right, because we never knew what was going to happen. And but there were a troop of people and an audience that really loved that. You know, so when you say, oh, why are these people showing up for? Why are these people showing up to see us do Brady Bunch episodes on stage? They can watch it on TV. Well, they want to see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why I have utter faith in the, like, future of theater and stuff. It like, right now, yeah, we're all sort of sitting in our homes not doing theater, but there is a need. There is a, like, natural need to want to go see what that thing is. I hear that's cool. Let's go see it. Or, like, yeah, you could watch it on TV, but these people are fun and funny, and I want to be near them. Yeah.
It's all about connection. Art is all about connection. Yeah. And I remember a couple of things. Dell used to talk about the group mind. And when I was studying with Dell, I thought the group mind was just the people I was on stage with. You know, just Blue Velveeta, that we were trying to get in the group mind. And then when another thing Dell said, he said, there are some things that I'm telling you that won't make sense to you for 10 years. And about 10 years later, I'm teaching it at Second City, and I realize. And I'm not saying I was the first to discover this. I'm just saying this is what I discovered. I'm like, it was a eureka moment for me, not for the world. But I realized that the group mind is everyone in the space, you know, and there's a connection. There's a connection there that when people see live theater, they're going to see, and this is the great thing about improv, you're going to see a snowflake, you know. But I think a big part, too, performers slow it down so you can tap into that energy.
Mm.
You know, with the nerves and everything, we get up, just ride it like a wave. It doesn't mean you have to slow down physically, but slow your energy. Listen. Does this make sense? Rest in the rhythm of the scene. Ride the wave.
Totally.
And be honest. It's about truth.
Do you think that that's your, like, now you've been in charge of a couple of theaters, you've led classes, you've taught stuff. Is that your style of creation, your vibe as a creator? Is that what you think about connection, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I do think it's about connection. I think I think, and I could be wrong too. I want to preface this. This is just my opinion at this moment.
It's just about you. Yeah.
Yeah. And if, yes, it's about connection. There's something special. And it doesn't have to be, it doesn't just connect with live theater. Like, there are a lot of people that are fans of Pulp Fiction, and they love to meet other fans of Pulp Fiction, the movie, or even the literary genre. But it's
true.
Nice to make a connection and a shared love. It's almost like being on the same team. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think my big part too is get out of your head and get into your heart. Stop thinking and feel. And then listen, because when you're in your head, that's where the fear lives. And when you're in fear, you're in the future and you're not in the present. Be in the present and be willing to make mistakes. From my experience, the people that are willing to make mistakes don't make mistakes, because if you're willing to make mistakes, mistakes don't exist. They're all gifts. Look for the love notes. Everything's a love note if you treat it as such.
Mm, totally.
Viktor Frankl improv.
So you've had quite a journey. You've created lots of things with lots of different people and performed all over the place. Been the leader of a couple of pardon the pun, institutions. What advice do you have for anybody who would want to follow in your footsteps, running a theater or performing wherever you feel the advice is coming right now?
I would say a couple things. One, be willing to be wrong. You know, that fear gets in the way. Fear and expectation will certainly stifle your creativity. Be willing to be wrong, because even if you're wrong, it'll teach you one thing that you need to make some adjustments. You know, but there's no such thing as wrong. You're wrong if you look at it as it's not an ongoing, lifelong process. Does that make sense? And trust yourself. Trust yourself and listen to the audience, not just for the laughs. The laughs are, but listen to see if what are you doing that they connect to, and build from that. Does that make sense? What are my talents? Build from what you are. Build from your talents rather than your strengths. rather than trying to improve your weaknesses, because that's where your gifts are.
Totally. Sometimes I think people are often trying to, you know, reject the things they're already good at in lieu of some other thing that they want. And it's like, yeah, that's great. You can do that too, maybe. But the thing that's going to really get you moving is what you're already great at.
If I went back in time, because I think I was a really strong, am a really strong director. I think that also helps me. I think I'm also a good teacher. Mm-hmm. I would have focused more on directing rather than performing. And, but my head was in a place where I had to be the star and rather than support someone and work in a group. But, and who knows, maybe the directing would have led to more performing. But at that time, my strength was really in directing and creating.
You know what, though? I really feel like being a performer is kind of a masterclass for directors. That when I meet a director, I see somebody who's never taken or been never taken an acting class and never tried to perform in a show. It's like, yeah, you're going to want to do that because you need to be able to navigate the cacophony in a way that, like, you speak the language. You know what I mean? Like, you're never going to talk somebody off a ledge in a language you don't speak. Like, you need to really be, like, to know what the vibe is, right? Like, I taught this, I taught this intensive, and it was a week-long intensive, and it was every day, 8 hours a day. And the first time that I did it, I wasn't the direct teacher. They just asked me to be sort of like the coordinator and like sit in the back and be with them the whole time, but not directly teach, just sort of like give people notes after and like care for people and like keep an eye on everybody and like make them go to lunch, stuff like that. Uh-huh. And I'm perfect for that. That's me for sure.
Yeah.
But being able to watch them and see this and be part of the experience with them really helped me when I was able to be part of the teaching staff. Because then I knew the vibe of the journey for them. I knew that we can't teach them the hardest things on Thursday because Thursday is burnout day. They're gonna be mad at everything that happens, so give them a simple lesson on Thursday. On Friday, they're gonna be over the moon. They're gonna do amazing things. They're gonna take leaps you never thought they could. But on Thursday, they're a waste of space just because of the journey, right?
Yeah.
Same with like a play. Or like putting on a show. Yeah, they're not great when we first start doing the technical aspects. They are disjointed and they don't know what they're doing. No one has their props or their costumes. But 2 days into it, they figured it out. They've worked it. So I don't get mad on the first day when everybody shows up and they're like, wait, are we doing tech stuff today? And you're like, yep, been on the schedule the whole time. What's up? How's everybody? Everybody ready? And I'm not mad because I know that's just what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the experience that you had, long story short, the experience you had as a performer actually makes you a better director, actually means that your experience that you put in doing it, trying it, being in front of audiences and learning what that is helps you to communicate better with other people who are new to the experience, who don't know what to expect. You know what I mean? So you're lovely and your journey is great. And I'm glad that you're here with me. So when Austin comes together again, we can be united together in a like, let's be creative and lovely together.
I'm building a stage in my backyard.
You should. Absolutely.
We will.
Yeah, for real. I mean, I've definitely done performances in a lot weirder places. When I went, I had an internship at Portland Stage Company in Maine, and they had like a storefront in front of that they owned, and it was a store that no one was renting. And I had an off period and was like, hey, can I put on a play in that empty space? And they're like, I guess so. And I was like, great. And I turned it into like a whole theater and like had audience and everything. And they were like, wow, I can't believe you did this. And I was like, you let me use a room. I'm going to turn it into a theater. That's me.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I think sometimes people, there's just a lack of imagination. I think a lot of times there are people, well, that's not the way it's supposed to be done. Like, what? Isn't it the point to think of a different way to use the resources you have available?
Right. Tom, thank you so much for being on the podcast and chatting with me and telling me all your great stories. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for letting me do it. I really appreciate it. It's good to see you.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.